and we're just getting ready to begin the Midrash for today. It is a group discussion, and the scriptures being read or being discussed this afternoon, Genesis 43, 24 through 44, 17. The Haftorah is Jeremiah 42:12 through 17, and 1 Kings 3:15. The Psalm is Psalm 37, and the Brit Hadashah is Luke 19:37 through 48. All right. Those are the scriptures for today. It is a group discussion. So, anyone who has anything to say, text it, raise your hand. In the meantime,
we go ahead and
do have a... All right, Mark is going to get us started.
Mark is going to get us started. Verse chapter 43, right, and verses 24 and following, right? 24, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me go ahead and read it, and we can discuss from there. And the man brought the men into Joseph's house and gave them water, and they washed their feet, and he gave their asses provender. And they made ready the present against Joseph, came at noon, for they heard that they should eat bread there. And when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in the hand of, which was in their hand into the house, and bowed themselves to him on the earth, to the earth. And he asked them of their welfare, and said, Is your father well, and the old man of whom you spoke? Is he yet alive? And they answered, Thy servant our father is in good health, he is yet alive. And they bowed down their heads and made obeisance. And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, Is this your younger brother, of whom you spake unto me? And he said, God be gracious unto thee, my son. And Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother. And he sought where to weep, and he entered into his chamber and wept there. And he washed his face and went out and refrained himself and said, Set on bread. And they set on for him by himself and for them by themselves and for the Egyptians which did eat with him by themselves, because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled one at another. And he took and sent messes unto them from before him. But Benjamin's mess was five times as much as any of theirs. And they drank and were merry with him. Let me make a couple of comments real quick. Like, as we're reading through here, we get to chapter 20 or verse 29, and it says, And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin and his mother's son. And he said, Is this your younger brother, of whom you spake unto me? Now remember the last time they were there, they said that their younger brother, you know, he was just a little guy, and there was, you know, the father would have died if his little son had died. They call him, actually, in the Stone Edition Tanakh, it says, your little brother, okay, as if he's just a little guy. In the meanwhile, when Yosef left, this little guy was already 8 or 9 years old. Okay, so he knew very well that it was not a little brother. He was a full-grown man. And so some of the rabbis see this as being a sarcastic way of asking this question. Is this your younger brother? This 31 or 32-year-old man that you have standing in front of me is your little brother? And then he says, peace be unto you, my son. As if to, you know, he's making fun of them and what they said. This is the way that some rabbis take this. That's according to the Stone Chumash, which I read last night, but I didn't bring with me, so I can't quote it verbatim. Then, okay, let me leave that open to other people's questions and comments now. Obeisance means that they bowed to him as if he was somebody special, which he is, really.
Why did they do that?
We're supposed to bow before God. That is true. But they did it because he was the guy in power. It doesn't matter whether it's right or not. That's what they did. No, they didn't know better than that. This is long before Torah was actually given from Mount Sinai now. Not to say that they didn't know that that was the wrong thing to do. Go ahead.
I don't believe it was a form of worship, but just a form of honor. And we have to remember, too, that Joseph was given the dream that was given by Yahweh, that his sheaf would stand up, representing himself, and all the other sheaves would bow down to him. So he was already told by Yahweh that his brothers would bow down in his presence.
We had a question. Is this the first time that Benjamin bowed?
There's actually another rabbinic tradition that Benjamin did not bow. I remember reading that also in the Chumash, but I can't recall it right to mind. It wasn't right in with the passage. But there is a rabbinic tradition among some rabbis, whether I don't know if it's majority or a very small minority or what, but there's tradition that he didn't bow at all.
I have a comment, Mark, regarding what you were saying about Benjamin. In that, for one thing, if they're saying, well, Elohim, show you favor, my son. I mean, hey, you know, you're a big guy, but listen, you know, you need favor here because they said you're a real weak guy or a real weakling or whatever. You really needed help, right? Well, were they not repeating, you know, what their father had said? I mean, I'm not saying that it's not all on them. I mean, they were... it's what Jacob had indicated to them that, you know, if he goes, I'm done for because he's my beloved son or he's one of my beloved sons. So they're just, quote, catering to their father in that one. So I'm aiming to think maybe Joseph is sort of mocking. I don't know. But
yeah. That is what the rabbis are saying, that he was kind of mocking the 10 older brothers. Right. Now you remember, the 10 were born within about 7 or 8 years of each other. Okay? There's not more than 7 or 8 years from the youngest of the 10 to the eldest of the 10. In fact, there's not more than that from Joseph to Reuben. And so, when they said little brother, you know, he knew very well that there's no way that we're talking about a little guy. Okay, and he didn't let on.
Right.
And then when the kid shows, this is your little brother? This guy's 6'8". Have you ever? Let me tell you something. I'm the youngest son in my family. Okay, my father was 5'7". I'm 6'4". I am 2 inches taller than my next tallest brother. I am the youngest boy. My son David is the youngest boy in my family. He is probably a quarter of an inch to a half inch taller than me. And all of my other kids are at least 2 inches shorter than me. And Daniel is a little shrimp. I mean, he's only like 5'11", compared to the rest of us. I mean, so, you know, it seems to be, at least from my own personal experience, that the youngest in a family is usually larger than the rest.
In my family.
And in your family? Your younger brother is bigger, is taller, and probably better looking, too, Ron.
No.
Oh, there you go, Susie. That's the way to come to your husband's aid. Anyway, that's the way it is in my own experience anyway. The younger brothers, at least in our family, is always the largest, usually the smartest, not in my case, but in David's case, and you know, it's just pretty much how it goes. Benjamin here is probably a very large man. From my experience, I would say that this is not just some little guy. He's a tall, well-built, strongly muscled young man. And, by the way, he already has like 3 or 4 kids by this time. So, anyway, other questions or comments? Okay, so now near the end of the chapter, verse 32, where it says that they set a table for Joseph, they set a table for the Egyptians, they set a table for the Israelites, the 11 brothers. And I have some questions that I'd like to ask. Joe ate separately from both his brothers and the Egyptians. Was this due to his position in Egypt that he sat separately? Was it just for now, for this particular meal? Or had he always set himself apart from the pagans? This is something that just came to mind while I was reading through here one time. Did Joseph actually practice divination like he says later in the... I don't think he did. I think he just heard from God. Okay? And, you know, he says, did you not think that I could practice divination? He was playing his part. And that's all he was doing, was playing a part in that particular case. But in this case, did he separate himself from the Egyptians all the time?
I think so.
I think he did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He was ruler.
Well, yeah, he's second in command of the whole country at this point. So that would also, they would probably set themselves apart from him. He is probably considered a god or a lesser god anyway in Egypt by the people. Although he would never have said himself at that. Okay. In the seating, you can see the role of Messiah in the reconciliation of Judah and Ephraim, as well as setting Israel apart from the nations. He set it up so that the brothers of Leah, or the sons of Leah and Rachel, are on one part of the table, and the other sons are on the other part of the table. Okay. He set them apart as well, showing that he knew who were the sons of the wives, and who were the sons of the concubines. Yeah, they're going, how can this possibly be? We've never seen this man before. Well, he was a teenager when he was taken away, and now he's a full grown man in his mid to late thirties. So he looks entirely different than what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact that he's not sporting a beard and he's perfectly clean shaven as an Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, other questions or comments?
So the word birthright has to do with the order you're suggesting for whether they were born of Leah or Bilhah or
yes.
Rachel or
yes,
anybody?
Yes, that's the way that I... That
okay.
It's not just me. Again, a bunch of rabbis hold the same position.
As
sons of wives and sons of concubines.
And not necessarily having to do with whether or not Reuben lost his birthright?
No, it went from... Any salient comments coming out of the peanut gallery and the web there? They're quiet today. They're behaving. Man, you guys are just disappointing me, I'll tell you what. Okay. If there's no more question or comment on chapter 34, let's go on to 44. Okay.
I thought it was interesting that in verse 29... that Joseph, when he was speaking to his brother Benjamin, said, may God be gracious to you, my son, or may Elohim. So he's speaking directly of Yahweh to be a blessing to him. So even though there was various types of gods that were worshipped within the whole pantheon of deity within the Egyptian culture and religious system, Joseph is speaking directly to his brother, his younger brother, and saying to him, may Yahweh be gracious to you, may Elohim be gracious to you. So he's definitely calling upon. What's that? Okay. All right, very good. That's what I had to say.
Oh, there is a question from Olive Tree. They wanted to know, what is the significance of five times the portion for Benjamin?
Yahweh be Elohim be gracious unto thee. Gracious. Five times. Five is a number that signifies grace in Scripture.
There you go.
No, he didn't eat five times as much food. He's a great big guy. He was given five times the portion, showing the grace of Yahweh that he would get a gracious provision.
Well, one thing that I know is they found a statue of Joseph in Egypt with the coat of many colors. And apparently it was some kind of plaid with a lot of colors. But the other thing about the statue of Joseph was, it was like a tartan. Because that's how they would have put the clothes together, right? Yeah. On the weave, or they would have woven. But he also had red hair.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the interesting things I found out about Benjamin here, and I believe that the size thing is true, is how many people have ever seen the Strongest Man contest? You know, you ever see those where they lift up the rocks and all that? But for a long time, the guys that were always winning were guys from Iceland, right?
Yeah.
In the early Icelandic sagas, it says, we are of the tribe of Benjamin. And I just wonder, well, maybe Benjamin was a big, strong guy. Or maybe these are his descendants. That's why they're big, strong guys that keep winning the Strongest Man contest. I don't know, but it's a possibility.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Saul was head and shoulders taller than anyone in the and he was a Benjamite.
That's true.
So, that's right.
This question is to Mark. When Joseph looked at Benjamin, did he look up to him or down to him?
Joseph was up on a dais. Okay, he was separated. He was up on a platform, probably 3 or 4 feet above everybody else. More than likely. And so Benjamin would have had to be very large in order to be looking down at Yosef.
Okay, another question to Mark. Wasn't the five portions to Ben, didn't Joseph want to see if the other brothers would become jealous of Benjamin, like they were jealous of Joseph?
That is definitely one of the things that the rabbis bring out. Thank you for reminding me. I just read that in the Chumash again last night. Yes, they actually do think that was a probability. They were looking to see how they would react. And, that's a really good observation, too. Because, remember, they threw this guy, you know, into a pit and sold him into slavery because he had a dream and he was given a coat that was, you know, of tartan wool, you know. If we believe David over here, which I have no doubt could be. Would they be, have they learned over the last 17 or 18 years, have they learned how to be more gracious? And it looks like they did.
Olive Tree wanted to know if you think that there would be any end time significance to the five times greater portion.
Not that comes right to mind, but that doesn't mean it's not right. Do you have anything that you might think, Olive Tree? Do you have anything that you think might have end time significance? Chicken. You're not an olive tree, you're a chicken.
But they are watching for it.
Okay. Well, yeah, the tribe of Benjamin was completely wiped out. There were only a few men left, and so that was early in the Judges. They had to completely rebuild that via the kinsman redeemer. Go ahead, Ron.
I was going to say, in regards to those five portions that Benjamin received, it looked like he wasn't really trying to hold it to himself, but it says that they feasted and drank freely with him. So apparently they just thought, well, he's got the most, let's dig in off on his side. So they just shared together. It was like one big happy family in many respects.
Cool. Yeah, very good observation.
I noticed, too, Joseph acts very politician-wise,
yeah.
You know, which is, you know, some people say we shouldn't get involved in politics or whatever, but if you look, he's very wise with all the things. It's almost Machiavellian, the things that he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Machiavellian, the prince. That's right. Okay. Anyone else? Other questions or comments? Shall we move on to chapter 44? I'll take that as an okay. Okay, it's chapter 44 through what? Verse 12? 13? And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food. By the way, many rabbis, and I mean many rabbis, I've heard it from a lot of different people, think that the steward of his house is his son Menasseh. Okay, just throw that out for you. Fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put every man's money in his sack's mouth. And put my cup, the silver cup, in the sack's mouth of the youngest, and his corn money. And he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away, they and their asses. And when they were gone out of the city, and not yet far off, Joseph said unto his steward, up, follow after the men, and when thou dost overtake them, say unto them, wherefore have ye rewarded evil for good? Is not this it in which my Lord drinketh, and whereby indeed he divineth? Ye have done evil in so doing. Verse 6. And he overtook them, and he spake unto them these same words. And they said unto him, wherefore saith my Lord these words? God forbid that thy servants should do according to this thing. Behold, the money which we found in our sacks' mouths we brought back again unto thee out of the land of Canaan. How then should we steal out of my Lord's house silver or gold? With whomsoever of the servants it be found, both let him die, and we also will be thy Lord's bondmen. And he said, now let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my master's, my servant, and ye shall be blameless. Then they speedily took down every man his sack to the ground, and opened every man his sack. And he searched, and began at the eldest, and left at the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they rent their clothes, and laded every man his ass, and returned to the city. How far did we go?
To verse 17.
17? Okay. And I thought we did. And Yehuda said to his brethren, and his brethren, came to Joseph's house, for he was yet there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said unto them, what deed is this that ye have done? Wot ye not that such a man as I can certainly divine? And Yehuda said, what shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? Or how shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants. Behold, both we and he also with whom the cup is found. And he said, God forbid that I should do so. But the man in whose hand the cup is found, he shall be my servant. And as for you, get you up in peace unto your father. Just on that last verse. That last verse shows that Joseph knew something of Torah, which says that a man will be held accountable for his own sins, not for the sins of his son, not for the sins of his father. Okay? And also not for the sins of his brother. So, that's just a quick aside. Go ahead, Susie. You have a mic in your hand.
Just actually back to verse 34, 43, 34, of course.
No, I'm sorry, you're not allowed. Go ahead.
Well, just thinking about Benjamin again and him being given all those portions, that he did turn out to be a leader in the tribe of Yehuda, and in Yehuda, as far as, you know, the Jews holding on to Yahweh's word, and then being responsible to give out the word. So the word being like the portions. So he again being
the other thing I just thought of, I think the apostles were from an area that was given to Benjamin. So, except for Judas and Shaul.
Just an idea on this. You'd mentioned that possibly Manasseh would be the steward. The only thing is, we're 2 years into the famine. It had only been 7 years before that, and so Joseph wasn't given the wife Ashkenaz until just at the time of the first of the times of rich and plenty. So it would make Manasseh at the most 8 years and some months old. Yeah, if Ashkenaz got pregnant immediately after.
Well, there were 7 years of plenty.
Right, and two more
and
years.
Followed by 7 years of famine. Yeah, he would have been at best 9, wouldn't he?
Yeah, the best probably 8 and some months.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, well, good point.
Okay. All right.
I'm just reporting what some rabbis are teaching. That's all right.
It could have been young steward.
Okay. Other questions, other comments?
According to the book of Jasher, at this point, when Joseph was threatening to hold their brother, the other brothers started threatening Joseph and Egypt. And one of the ways they did it was Judah did feats of strength by juggling large boulders, and then when he was done, he sat down on one and smashed it into pieces. So Joseph then called his son Manasseh, who repeated the same feat of strength that Judah did, to match Judah's strength.
That's in the book of Jasher.
That is, that's some kind of noxious fumes that Judah was putting out, huh? Wow. Wow. Are there any other questions or comments here? Silver represents redemption. The double portion of grain in Benjamin's sack speaks to Benjamin gaining more Torah knowledge from Yosef. Okay. In verse 14, Judah and his brethren came to Joseph's house, for he was yet there. Reuben was the eldest, so why didn't he come to Joseph's house? Okay? Judah was the natural leader, that's why. Where are we? Okay, he had also made himself surety for Benjamin. He shows his royalty right here. That he shows his responsibility. Now, Judah has become something of a hero here. Remember, Judah was the one who, at least the rabbis say, Judah was the one who said, look, here comes that dreamer with the coat. Let's put him in a pit. He's the one that actually sold him into slavery. He's the one who lost two sons because they wouldn't be kinsman redeemer. He's the one who sinned with Tamar. Okay? This man has gone through over the last 17 or 18 years.
And fought
for Dinah. That was before. But yeah, he fought for Dinah. This guy has gone through quite a bit in his life. And he has become quite mature. Even for, you know, a guy who was raised by Jacob. Become quite mature. Simeon and Levi, that's right. It wasn't Judah, wasn't involved. Okay, sorry. Okay, so that was with Dinah. But yeah, that's...
He's gone through a lot.
He's gone through a whole lot, Judah has. And he's learned quite a bit from it. And it shows right here, where he takes responsibility for the sin, the apparent sin of his brother. He says, he's going to say next week, I told my father that this boy would come back and it would be my life. Okay, so please don't. And anyway, we'll read that next week. But Judah became a man in those 17 or 18 years, a real man. John Wayne kind of man. Louis L'Amour hero kind of man. I mean, we're talking a man. ahead.
Yeah, I just agree with what Mark was saying, that he was willing to take responsibility for the entire household of his father. He was willing to lay everything on the line because he recognized that what his father had as his dream, he was willing to embrace as well. And I think that's an important thing, is when a son recognizes all the dreams or all the ambition and is willing to then recognize the importance of it and carry that dream into the future.
Okay, anybody else?
Someone mentioned something about a statue of Joseph in Egypt earlier.
Yes, that would have been David. Here you go, David.
Now, they just want to know, is there a website? Is there a place they can see it?
I don't remember where.
Hey, here you go. Google Joseph statue in Egypt. I'll bet you'll come up with it.
That's always a good answer. Just Google it.
Okay, other questions or comments? Hey, Stephen, go ahead.
Just wondering why Joseph wanted to bring his brothers back to Egypt almost through fear. Like, he wanted to put them in a position, a vulnerable position where they're scared and they're frightened. I mean, why didn't he just tell them? I mean, like, personally, I just think maybe it was because he wanted them to be, when you're scared and then you're recompensed or you're found out to be okay, that you're especially happy, you're especially passionate. So it could be that he wanted to scare his brothers so that they were like, oh wow, oh Joseph, you know, so glad to see you.
Could be. I think that he wanted that was the end result, would have been the end result of what he's doing, but I think probably he was trying to give them just a taste of what he had to go through too. Okay? And after having had that taste, then being delivered, okay, that would, I think that you got a good point there.
I'm wondering, too, if Joseph just, knew about his own birthright somehow, and he was actually honoring it and claiming the leadership that was going to be given him. No, I'm talking about Joseph. That Joseph was commanding respect, not out of lording it over so much, but just his position as a leader in the family, even though, you know, that's not where his birthright, I mean, or birth order, I mean, just that he understood that, given the dream and all, that he was going to be, have the position of a birthright.
I would agree with that, just as I was sharing about Judah. Gaining the vision of what his father and the whole family of Israel represents. I believe even more than Judah, I believe that Joseph had a greater understanding of the implications of the tribes of Israel and what they would mean to the whole entire world. I think he was got a great understanding. I think that he did spend a lot of time with his father, Jacob, and Jacob would recite him the things that had come to him down from Abraham and Isaac and had been then instilled within his own life. And I think that Joseph could see that there was a future, a destiny, a Savior that was to come forth from the tribe of Israel, from Jacob's loins. And he was recognizing he wanted to take and try to bring some sense into his brothers as well, to realize we have implications as those who are going to be the patriarchs of the world. They have an incredible responsibility. The fate of the entire world rested upon these 12 men in many respects. That's right, they're descendants. And we see that Joseph looking ahead through eyes of destiny, recognizing what the future would hold for them as a people, and recognizing that they needed to be able to pull together, they needed to
they needed to go through difficulties, as Judah had gone through, as Mark had pointed out, Judah had gone through difficulties which had tempered him. And it, even Messiah Yeshua said that he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. And when we are chastised of Yahweh, we should not think it strange, but we should think of it as a father even chastening his own son, that we have a responsibility to then respond and in grace thanking him for the, not for just the trials, but for thanking him for the purification that it brings into our lives, for the destiny that lies before us. And that's what we have to focus on even now. In the days that we live, it's not so much now focusing on the times that we live, but knowing that these times in which we live become for us a platform, even a diving point into our destiny. And so let these times be that which purifies us by drawing ever nearer to our Elohim and our Savior, Messiah Yeshua.
I wanted to comment too that Joseph told his brothers, you know, all this was by Elohim's doing. It was by his ordination that he made this happen for his plan and purpose. And just the way he was hidden from his brothers and then he revealed himself and he put them through humiliation and humility. So Yeshua did the same when he revealed himself and kept himself hidden until the time was right to be revealed. And also, just when he returns, and there's the fullness of the fullness of Israel and the 12 tribes coming back together at the right time when he will reveal himself. So, just another note too, I wanted to ask about when it says in 44:13 that the brothers tore their garments and each man loaded his donkey and went back to the city. What that looks like, if it just meant they rent their clothing. What that really looks like, I mean, I know it's a sign of like desperation, and but yeah, just maybe any other comments.
Yeah, rending the clothes was a sign of mourning, humility. So when they did that, they were actually going into mourning because they knew that they were going to lose their brother, and that would destroy their father. And I really think that that was the whole idea from Joseph's standpoint, so they could actually feel what they had put their father through already. And go ahead, Susie.
A question regarding where in 14, and Yehuda and his brothers came to Yosef's house, and he was still there. Just the point of saying that he was still there, almost as if maybe he wouldn't have normally been there. Or so just, you know, the reason for pointing that out, I guess, is what I'm looking for commentary on.
Yeah, I would suppose that that's exactly right. He would normally have been gone back out to do whatever his job was, and he decided he wanted to be there when they got back, so that they could see that he knew that this was he thought that this was a very important thing that they had done. Okay, and I think he also knew that he was going to be revealing himself to them right then. So, go ahead, Ron.
The scriptures declare that he who covers his sin shall not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes his sin will be healed and be blessed. And we have in verse 16, Judah is saying, Elohim has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves. Yahweh did not want this sin to continue to be within the household of Israel. And so he has put a purging to take it and to remove it. It's a difficult thing. When sin is in our lives, it's not always an easy thing to get it out. It begins with confession, but it can be done. He has the power through Messiah, Yeshua, to be able to bring about a cleansing in our life. But it isn't always an easy road, and it usually is not an easy road, depending on the level to which that sin will go. But He wants it out of our lives. That's His desire, is to have a clean and chaste bride that He's going to bring into holy matrimony with himself. And that's the place that we have, to desire to be clean of sin and to seek a place, a purity of lives. And so with this in our heart, he works to bring about that end. Even sometimes we don't want it, but it'll come about because he wants to make us pure.
Yeah, I said holy matrimony, Batman. How Catholic of you. Holy matrimony. Sorry. Are there any other questions or comments? Divines. Oh, divining? Okay. He's talking about telling the future or looking beyond, you know, second sight kind of stuff. He's telling them that he has power to spiritually see things because of this silver goblet. Now, that is not what he really was saying, but he was giving them that idea. He's playing the part, like I said earlier, of being someone who can do that kind of thing, a magician, basically.
Because in a sense, he did divine by Yahweh's power. I mean, he had dreams that,
yes, that
were foretelling the future, and in a sense, you almost think he already knew that Judah was the one that was going to take the place for Benjamin. Because, I mean, I don't know, but it kind of alludes that way because he brought it to this climactic point and was the one who had the cup.
Yeah.
You know, and it was his father. So Benjamin is the favorite next to Joseph, but he doesn't know that Joseph is. He thinks he's dead, so he already knows. And he probably did that. Benjamin was next to his father's favorite, next to him.
Right. Yeah, it seems like the chapter 43 pretty much focuses on Benjamin and Joseph and their thing. You don't see a whole lot. There isn't anything here about Judah that I can see talking to Joseph up until the time that they're coming back. That's when Judah really stepped forward. I don't know. Is there anything in the first trip to Egypt that would give him the idea that Judah would be the guy to deal with? I don't know. But in other words, I don't actually see an allusion here, but I also don't have any problem believing that Joseph was able to see actually who the main blessings were going to go to from Jacob. I mean, he knew very well that he was going to get one of the blessings. And maybe he thought he was going to get it all. I don't know, but you know, the fact was that Judah was going to get the kingship while Joseph was going to be the righteous one. And the Melchizedek priesthood is at that point broken into two lines. And they're brought back together in Messiah, who becomes the Melchizedek priest.
When Yaakov gave Joseph the coat of Melchizedek, did he not give him the birthright then? Or was that just that he was singled out as being the favorite, but I don't think there was any delineation of blessing then. Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Anything in Pal Talk that's... No? Okay. Anything else on the Torah portion for today? Going once... Going twice, I'm already turning towards Jeremiah. Going three times. Yirmiyahu. What was the chapter 43?
42. 12 through 17.
You want to go to 1 Kings and read it? Go ahead.
Okay.
Because I'm already at Jeremiah. I'm not going anywhere else until.
Jessica can teach on 1 Kings, and we'll let you handle Jeremiah. Jessica, the floor is yours.
1 Kings 3:15 is the verse. And Shlomo awoke, and see, it was a dream. And he came into Yerushalayim, and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, and offered up burnt offerings and made peace offerings, and he made a feast for all his servants. So, 1 Kings 3:15.
Okay, are there any questions or comments on that?
Well, just maybe a general observance is that I just see Shlomo is certainly honoring Yahweh as Lord, as Master, as Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and realizing that his way is the only way. And so he's offering up things that are set aside to Yahweh as he has ordained, as Yahweh has ordained. I mean, he's doing it. He's honoring in what Yahweh has said. So he's showing Yahweh to be, the ultimate ruler.
Yeah, it's interesting that he has this particular. He had this dream immediately after he prayed for wisdom to judge Israel, and Yahweh told him, you could have had anything. You could have asked for anything, and I'd have given it to you. But because you asked for wisdom, I'm going to give you all those other things as well. Okay? So after that was all done, then he went and he sacrificed, and he has this vision. And goes immediately to Jerusalem to offer before the ark, is what he's going to do next. The dream had spoken to his heart. The next incident convinces him that the dream was real. And the next incident is when the two women come to him with the baby. Right. So, questions? Comments?
Comment. Just seeing the connection between Joseph and Solomon, in that Joseph was a beloved of his father, and Solomon was also a beloved of his father, David. And Yahweh spoke to both of them in the form of dreams, and both of them were elevated to high positions of authority, with a governmental responsibility over their people. And this time also it comes to the point where, as my wife was pointing out, Susie, she said that, and they prepared a feast. And so there was again another connection, that there was a feast that was prepared. I think what it means is just that there was a blessing upon their lives, an overflowing blessing of prosperity. We see that both in Joseph and his his power and reign of Egypt, and then also Solomon, his reign over Israel, has such great abundance been seen in any particular nation, at least the nation of Israel, as that which was displayed by Solomon in his reign. I imagine for Joseph in his reign of Egypt. Okay.
Anyone else on that verse? Anything? Let's jump over to Jeremiah then. That was 42 verses 12 through the end of the chapter. Is that correct? Or was it 40? 12 through 17. That's what I thought. Okay, starting in verse 12. And I will shew mercies unto you, and that he may have mercy upon you, and cause to return to your own land. Cause you to return to your own land. But if you say, we will not dwell in this land, neither obey the voice of Yahweh your Elohim, saying, no, but we will go into the land of Egypt, where we will see no war, nor hear the sound of the trumpet, nor have hunger for bread. And there will we dwell. And now, therefore, hear the word of Yahweh, ye remnant of Judah. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the Elohim of Israel, if ye wholly set your faces to enter into Egypt, and go to sojourn there, then it shall come to pass that the sword, which ye feared, shall overtake you there in the land of Egypt, and the famine whereof you were afraid shall follow you close after you there in Egypt, and there you shall die. So shall it be with all the men that set their faces to go into Egypt to sojourn there. They shall die by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence, and none of them shall remain or escape from the evil that I will bring upon them. For thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, as mine anger and my fury have been poured out upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so shall my fury be poured forth upon you, and ye shall enter into Egypt, and ye shall be an execration, and an astonishment, and a curse, and a reproach, and ye shall see this place no more. Yahweh hath said concerning you, O remnant of Judah, go ye not into Egypt. Know certainly that I have admonished you this day. For ye dissembled in your hearts, when ye sent me unto Yahweh your Elohim, saying, pray for us unto Yahweh our Elohim. And according unto that, all that Yahweh will, your Elohim will say, so declare to us, and we will do it. And now I have this day declared it to you. But ye have not obeyed the voice of Yahweh your Elohim, nor any thing for the which he hath sent me unto you. Now therefore know certainly that ye shall die by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence, in the place whither ye desire to go and to sojourn. Okay, back in verse 14. I haven't mentioned Egypt even once up to this point. Did you know that?
Up until 14.
Up until verse 14. The guys had never said, they people who said, go and pray for us and we'll do it, never said anything about Egypt. How did Jerry know their plans? Why didn't they ask this question? They're following their own halakha, not Yahweh's. That's what I've got so far. Anything else? Anybody got any questions or comments?
Yes, I think it's interesting in that what had been given to Jeremiah at the very beginning of his ministry, he was shown a basket of fruit, and both one that was, two baskets of fruit, actually, one that was of good fruit, another was spoiled and rotten. And the good fruit was that which was taken away in the first deportations to Babylon, but those that continued to remain in the land of Judah were looked upon as being a rotten and corrupt fruit. And when the word of Yahweh was given to them to repent, even though they understood it, they continued to harden their heart, just as Zedekiah, the final king, he was told that if he would just turn and surrender to Nebuchadnezzar, that he would be preserved. But he was afraid of his advisors. He was afraid, and because he was corrupted in his own life. And so that he went ahead and tried to escape, and the very thing that Jeremiah had prophesied about him came to pass. And here these people said, seek the face of Yahweh. These are the ones that had basically had escaped into other areas surrounding Judah. And then when there was a time of peace because of the governor that was established over the land of Judah because of Nebuchadnezzar, that they kind of came back in. But then there was a warring band that came in and killed the governor. And so now this group of people that are there wondering, what should we do? Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to hear about this governor that's been killed, and then he's going to want to destroy us as well. We need to flee. So again, they said, well, Jeremiah, seek Yahweh's counsel for us, and we will truly do it. We will do it. If you seek Yahweh's counsel, we'll do it. And sure, they lied again, because they had it in their heart, just as Mark had said, they had it in their heart to do something contrary, and they wanted to hear what they wanted to hear. And when he spoke a word that was different, which would require faith, which would require trust in Yahweh, and not just in their own devices, or their means of escape and their own strength, well then, of course, that's what happened. They were then convicted, not they weren't really convicted, but they were brought into the evidence of the light of the truth of Yahweh, because Jeremiah said, you're going to go down to Egypt. This is what you're going to do. And you know what's going to happen? You're going to corrupt yourself down there. And exactly that's what happened. They went down to Egypt, and the first thing that the women started doing was begin offering sacrifices to the Queen of Heaven there, and begin to start embracing all the pagan deities of Egypt. Because they wanted to do what they wanted to do. They didn't really want to serve. They didn't know Yahweh. They didn't know his heart or his love for them. Even at that time, even though he looked upon them and saw how corrupt they were, he was still giving them a chance. He was giving them an opportunity to do the right thing. But they didn't choose life. They chose death.
Also, with that
it was Yahweh was sovereign in the midst of it, because it says, well, back up to verse 5, it says, "And they said to Yirmiyahu, let Yahweh be a true and steadfast witness between us. If we do not do according to all the word which Yahweh Elohim sends us by you, whether good or evil, let us obey the voice of Yahweh Elohim, to whom we send you." So, it was Yahweh's word that they were going to be going into Mitzrayim, because they had hardened their hearts, and it was good or evil. I mean, it was evil in the sense that they were not being obedient, but it was what Yahweh already knew was going to happen. He was sovereign, and it was declared by the word of Yirmiyahu. Though he, you know, it's like he gave them a choice. He gave them this way and this way, and he told them, this is what you're going to do, and it was evil by the mouth of Yahweh, and they did it. So it was just, you know, he was sovereign in the midst of it too, and just recognizing that he knew what they were going to choose, it was for his purpose and plan.
That's good. Other questions, other comments? God revealed Yohanan's heart to Jeremiah. Yohanan meant to go to Egypt no matter what Yahweh revealed to Jerry. It says right here in verse 20, "For ye dissembled in your hearts when you sent me unto Yahweh your God, saying, pray for us unto Yahweh our Elohim, and according unto all that Yahweh our Elohim shall say, so declare unto us, and we will do it." They were dissembling in their hearts. Joseph knew very well that what they said was a lie. He just wanted Yahweh's, and Yohanan just wanted Yahweh's endorsement for his own decision. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's what he was looking for. And back to the verses 5 and 6, and they said to Jeremiah, okay, whether it be good or whether it be evil, this is very reminiscent of what the Israelites did at the foot of Mount Sinai, where God said, Yahweh said, if you'll do this, then I'll do that. And they said, whatever you say, we'll do. Mm-hmm. And they said that four different times. They said, whatever Yahweh says through Moses, we'll do. Whatever Moses, whatever Yahweh tells you to do, we'll do it. And Moses went away for 40 days, and they went exactly against everything that Yahweh told them to do.
But they promised to do it.
But they promised to do it four times. He held them to their promise. Same deal here. This is what these guys are looking for. They're looking for Yahweh's endorsement of their own decisions. And I'll tell you what, Jeremiah never, never, ever endorsed anybody else's decision but Yahweh's. Okay? I mean, they threw him in a pit that was, it was where they dumped their toilets into this pit. And they threw him into a miry pit. That's what it's talking about. It was like the bottom of a two-holer out in the Amish country. Seriously, they threw him in the pit of the outhouse. And that's why, you know, I forget what the guy's name was that came to the king and said, "This guy's going to die. You can't leave him there." The eunuch came in and got him out of there. He knew that was coming. Believe me, he knew that was coming. And yet he went ahead and said what Yahweh told him to say anyway. Because it's better to die in a pit full of slime than it is to go against Yahweh.
Do you notice also that a lot of times the true prophets of Yah are telling maybe the people things they don't want to hear?
Absolutely.
And the false prophets back then were the ones telling them stuff that were itching their ears and the things that...
Right.
Now look at today. It's the same way today.
That's right.
There's all kinds of so-called prophets running around saying things that the people want to hear, you know, all these things. The latest one was about Highway 35 being God's holy highway, and it's going to change
right.
America and cause this great revival. Here it's an instrument of the New World Order.
Right.
You know, so same things happen.
Exactly right. Other questions or comments? 1 Kings, Jeremiah. Going once. Going twice. Do I sound like the auctioneers in Amish country there?
Only when they say sold. That's my favorite word.
That's your favorite word, sold? Okay, then let's move on to Psalm 37. I have a lot of stuff about Psalm 37. I think I'm going to let somebody else talk for a while, though.
Why?
Well, because I don't want to steal everybody's thunder. Okay? So I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to read the first 20 verses, and we'll go through that, and then I'll read the next 20 verses when we're done talking about that. Okay. Psalm 37. Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity. For they shall soon be cut down like the grass, and wither as the green herb. Trust in Yahweh and do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Delight thyself also in Yahweh, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart. Delight thyself, I got to stop right there. Delight thyself also in Yahweh, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Do you know that if you're delighting yourself in Yahweh, your heart has become his? And therefore, he's going to give you the desires of your heart, because the desires of your heart are the desires of his heart. Okay? Yeah. Commit thy way unto Yahweh, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. And he shall bring forth thy righteousness as the light, and thy judgment as the noonday. Rest in Yahweh, and wait patiently for him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait upon Yahweh, they shall inherit the earth. For yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight thyself in the abundance of peace. Does this stuff sound familiar to anybody? The wicked plotteth against the just, and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. Yahweh shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. Man. Yahweh shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. The wicked have drawn out the sword, and have bent their bow, to cast down the poor and the needy, and to slay such as be of upright conversation. Their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but Yahweh upholdeth the righteous. Yahweh knoweth the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. But the wicked shall perish, and the enemies of Yahweh shall be as the fat of lambs. They shall consume into smoke, shall they consume away. Wow, they shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. That's exactly what happened in Egypt, and that's exactly what's going to happen in the greater Exodus. Yahweh is going to take care of us. Okay? He delivered Israel through Egypt. He'll deliver us as well. Well, no, they didn't just sit there and wait. No. No, absolutely. They worked the whole time.
You mean they didn't stand there and wait?
They didn't stand there and wait. They didn't sit there and wait. No, they while they were standing, they were probably walking and picking the grain. Go ahead, Susie.
Verse 6, and he shall bring forth your righteousness as the light and your right ruling as midday. It reminded me of when Yosef set dinner down with his family. It was at midday.
Other questions or comments?
Oh. I just want to make a comment about gnashing the teeth. I don't know if I've mentioned that here before, but there was one time I was involved with Volunteers of America, and we were taking care of a very large boy, He was like 6'5", 350. And he got very upset and started striking out on Jeremiah when he was little, and I had to take him down. And he started gnashing his teeth. He ground his teeth so loud that Joshua and Jason, three floors up, could hear it. It's no joke. It's very, very loud and eerie sounding. Mm-hmm. It's like a chalkboard thing almost.
Yeah, it's the teeth grind so loudly that when we were first married, my wife used to do that all the time. I think it was in a reaction to me from all day, but she was. But in her sleep, she would grind her teeth, and it was loud enough to awaken me. Okay, so
I used to grind my teeth, but I never knew I did. That's why, because my dad in fact had me make a mouthpiece that I put in my mouth because I would grind my teeth when I was in the middle of my night in the sleep. But I never knew what it sounded like, and I never heard myself. They would always say, "Jessica, stop, stop."
Like to squeeze his jaw together, just grind his teeth.
Yeah, there are five mentions of the words inherit the earth. There are two other mentions of the word inherit or inheritance. And there are also two other mentions of the earth, okay, in different places. So you've got five times inherit the earth. That talks about the grace of Yahweh as well. The inheritance times seven, seven being the number of perfection, and the earth times seven, the number of perfection. So that's all pretty cool stuff if you just look at it just from that angle. Let's see. I'm looking up the word the earth. I think it's going to be Haaretz, but other questions or comments real quick, like, go ahead.
Verse 23, the steps of a righteous man are ordered or established by Yahweh, and he delights in this way. It's a blessing. It's an excitement. It's an encouragement. It's a sense of well-being that comes to someone when they feel that, when they are sensing that the hand of Yahweh is upon them, and they've been walking in a way that they believe and perceive as good, and they sense Yahweh's encouragement and undergirding. I'm reminded in the movie Chariots of Fire where Eric Little is speaking with his sister, and she's concerned about him being caught up in his running and this whole preparation for the Olympics. And to dispel her worries, her fears about him being so caught up in the system, Eric is speaking to her and says, "But you see, when I run, I feel his pleasure." And it's a sense where you recognize that what you're doing and what you enjoy, you know, like the desires of your heart become the desires of his heart. He was using that as an opportunity to not glorify himself, but glorify Yahweh. And as a result of that, Yahweh is glorified, and he uplifts the man, because the man is then able to continue to remain humble, because it's like what it talks about, inheriting the earth are those that are meek and humble. And so if you have this combination, you can't lose.
In my Bible, it gives titles to the chapter or whatever, and on this chapter it says God takes care of his own. And I was just wondering, is it considered a sin to start to prepare for the time of trouble that's coming in any way that you can? And if you're given something that you perceive might help you to that end, is that wrong to think of that as, this is my going to help be my help in the time of need? Or are we supposed to just sit back and wait, and he'll take care of us, and we don't have to worry about anything? For my own part, I think that really when it comes that desperate time of trouble, where nothing else is going to help us but the Father himself to be with us, and we're going to have to totally trust and rely on him for every which way we turn in everything we do. But until that time comes, is it wrong to take advantage and to prepare for that time that's coming for a time?
Joseph didn't think it was wrong to store grain for 7 years.
And some of the things that you might get could be him giving you stuff to prepare you, too.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of the story of a guy had his boat had sunk, and he prayed to God, please help me, you know. And along comes a guy in a boat, fisherman. He says, can I give you a hand? He says, no, I'm waiting for God to help me. You know? And the next one, the helicopter comes flying over, and they go to drop a line to him. He says, no, waiting for God to help me. No. Pretty soon the guy dies. He says, gets to the pearly gates. What's the matter? I was waiting for you to help me. He said, well, I sent you the boat. I sent you a guy with a life preserver. I sent you the helicopter. How much help did you think I was going to send? Exactly right.
Jackie says that we should be doing that, that we should always be expecting the best and preparing for the worst, so when the worst comes, we are prepared.
I also want to add in Proverbs 22 and verse 3. It says, the prudent man, or it says also the clever one, foresees the evil and hides himself, but the simple go on and are punished. So there we have a very clear declaration out of Scripture saying that someone who sees it far off coming and prepares himself is someone who is going to be blessed, whereas the simple, or the one who is not recognizing and not really caring, go on and are punished.
Other questions or comments? A little more here. For they shall soon be cut down. Soon to Elohim could be hundreds of years to us. Okay? For they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. What's, like I said there, soon to him can be 100 years, can be 1,000 years. To us, it's a long, long time. So we may not see the soon happen, okay? But that doesn't mean it's not going to. The wicked will get theirs in the end. And it says that, said that down here. I read it a couple of times, didn't I? Where Yahweh shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his end is coming. Okay? We don't see that the end of the wicked man is coming. But Yahweh does. And he just laughs at the arrogance of the wicked, saying, well, there is no God, you know. Where's the promise of his coming? Everything is as it's always been. Yeah, well, you know what? God just laughs at them because he knows what their end is. He's not laughing because he's happy that they're going to go to that end. He's laughing because he's holding them in derision because they're stupid. They think they're so wise and they're such idiots. Thinking themselves wise, they professing themselves to be wise, they become fools and change the glory of God into the glory of creeping things.
I would agree with what Mark is saying. It's confirmed by Psalms chapter 2 and verse 4. It says, he who sits in the heavens laughs.
Yeah.
Yahweh scoffs at them. Now we see, it's not a situation like Mark was saying where he's having derision over them because of being caught in a difficult circumstance. It's because they themselves have laid the trap for themselves, and he's tried to help them, just like the situation would happen with those that were being counseled by Jeremiah. They refused to receive the counsel, and so as a result of they're walking directly into the very warning that they were given, and they suffer the consequences.
What'd he say? the Druze are getting ready to leave, so we're going to lose about two-thirds of our input here. look at verse 3-6. Verses 3-6. Trust in Yahweh and do good, so shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Delight thyself also in Yahweh, and he shall give thee desires of thine heart. Commit thy way unto Yahweh, trust also unto him, and he shall bring it to pass. And he shall bring forth thy righteousness in the light, as the light, and thy judgment as at the noonday. Rest in Yahweh, wait patiently for him, fret not yourself because of him that prospers in his way, because of the men who bring wicked devices to pass. Okay, he's let's count here for just a minute. Trust in Yahweh, do good, delight thyself in Yahweh, commit thy way unto Yahweh, rest, and wait patiently for him. That's what, six things here? Yeah. And then what follows all of that? So shalt thou dwell in the land, verily thou shalt be fed. He shall give thee the desires of thine heart. He shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth thy righteousness as the light and thy judgment as the noonday. Six things come as a result. Okay? Very interesting. If you do these things, God will do those things. That is something that happens all through Scripture. If you'll do this, then I'll do that. If you'll do this, then I'll do that. If you don't do this, then I'm going to make this happen to you. Yeah, how do you stop fretting? I don't know how to answer that question. I don't generally fret about most anything. So I have a real hard time relating to somebody who does. I mean in that particular area, because I don't know why it is that Yahweh has made me that way, but I just know that he's going to do right by me, and you know, it doesn't matter what anyone else does.
Jackie says that isn't that because Yahweh directs our paths according to our hearts? If our hearts is to do his will, our paths will be straight. And if our hearts is to do what Yah desires, then your heart will lead to destruction.
I think she meant if you don't do what Yahweh desires.
Yeah, if our hearts is not to do, is
yes.
To do not what he desires.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You got it right. If your heart is to do his will, he'll see to it that you're taken care of. If your heart is not to do his will, he'll let you go your own way. Not hard. But other questions, other comments? Yeshua Tov Druze family. Yeah, verse 7 again. To rest in Yahweh is to wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself because of him who prospers in his way. See, this says fret not yourself because of him who prospers in the way. Okay? It doesn't say don't fret yourself.
Okay?
Yeah, or necessarily what they can do to you, because what they can do to you is nothing. Okay? Yeah, the fret is not over what other people have. In this particular case, it's fretting over what they're going to try to do to you. They can, no matter what happens in this world, if somebody sues you for $10 million and wins, and you've only got $150 to pay them, that means you're going to be in a judgment for a long, long time, and everything that you make is going to be going to that person. You know what? It says that if you're called according to Yahweh's purpose, that is going to work together for your good. Okay? It doesn't look like it to you, especially while it's happening. It sure doesn't look like it to you. It doesn't feel like it, but it's the truth. So you kind of have to keep yourself in this word and believe what you're reading. And that's probably the key. I just believe what this book says. So that's really all I've got on that. Any other questions or comments here? Okay, rest in Yahweh, wait patiently on Him. That's in verse 7. In verse 9 it says, those who wait upon Yahweh, they shall inherit the earth. Wait upon Yahweh, if you look back down to verse 11, it says, but the meek shall inherit the earth, shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. It's interesting here. Then verse 29, the righteous shall inherit the land, also the same word, okay, and shall dwell therein forever. In verse 22, for such as be blessed of him shall inherit the earth. These things are all synonyms, okay? Resting, waiting patiently, waiting upon Yahweh, meek, blessed of him, righteous. That those all describe the same thing, and the reward of all those things is to inherit the earth. Okay. Now, what earth is he talking about? Is he talking about this earth that we're standing on right now? Or is he talking about the one that he's going to be creating after the great white throne judgment? That's the one I think he's talking about. We're going to inherit that earth, and that earth is going to be a whole lot better to inherit than this one. Okay. Other questions or comments here? Okay, all together, Psalm 37 looks to be an instruction manual in how to live in the time of Jacob's trouble. Okay? The bad guys are going to look like they've got it all. The good guys are going to look like they got nothing. The bad guys are going to look like they've got all the power. The good guys are going to look like they got no power. But Yahweh is going to see to it that they get taken care of. That both get taken care of. Remember in verse 13? Yahweh shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. He knows the end from the beginning. So he's laughing at this guy that's shaking his fist at God and saying, I don't even believe that you exist. Okay? He's going to take care of the person who's meek, humble before Yahweh. Again, that's all I got for now. Anybody else? Questions or comments? We have other things here. Verses 22 through 24. I got a lot of things circled and a lot of things squared, and that's the way that I mark stuff off. Blessed of him, good man, he delighteth in Yahweh's way. Though he fall, he shall be. For Yahweh upholdeth him. Okay, and then, blessed of him shall inherit the land. He's a good man. His steps are ordered by Yahweh. He delights in Yahweh's way. See all this stuff. I mean, there is some great truth to put in your head and keep there in this psalm. This is just an incredible psalm. And it goes well beyond Mark 37:37a that I use laughingly as my life verse, Mark the perfect man. Okay? Oh yeah, we're in the Psalm 37. There's a microphone right there. My son wants to give his interpretation of the verse. No, it's not all that funny, but I'm going to let him do it anyway.
Mark 30, Psalm 37:37C is for the end of that man is peace.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
So,
are you ready?
Yeah.
What does the word end mean?
Well, end, you know.
No.
The end.
No. Well, the end, okay. The last thing that guy does, what is it? Peace. Okay? Now, what the word actually means is not end as in the last thing, but the end as in the purpose for that man is peace. Okay?
Yeah. The end is that end.
Yeah, absolutely. The future of that man is peace. There you go. The purpose of his existence is for him to have peace with Yahweh. That's the purpose of every man's existence. Do you know that? That is the gospel in a nutshell. You can have peace with Yahweh. Everything else that goes along with the gospel, all the mechanism by which it's done, Yeshua dying on the cross, on the tree, and being buried and resurrected and ascended into heaven, sitting at the right hand of the Father, that stuff is how it's delivered to us. But the actual gospel is, you are an enemy of Yahweh, and you can have peace with Him. Okay? Now, let me tell you how. Right? That's the way that works. You can have peace with Yahweh. That is the end of you of the perfect man. And perfect doesn't mean no fault. Perfect means complete. Someone who is complete in Yahweh. Other questions or comments? Sorry, I didn't read the last half of the chapter, but here's verse 39. But the salvation of the righteous is of Yahweh. He is their strength in the time of trouble. There you go. That's what this is all about. When the time of trouble comes, this is the psalm you want to have memorized. Okay? So that you'll remember that even though you're going through all the hardship and you just feel like the weight of the world has been thrown on you, you'll be able to remember, if I just follow him, if I wait patiently for him, if I rest in Yahweh, if I do all those things, he will deliver me and I will have peace. And you know what? It'll do a lot to help you have peace in the situation, to know that you're going to have perfect peace very soon. Anything else? I'm getting tired of being the only guy talking here. Let's move on to the Brit Hadashah then. Luke chapter 19. Not Acts, Luke. The other book written by Luke. It was chapter 19, is that correct? And the last 12 verses.
They're saying they're just good listeners.
They're just good listeners. Okay. Starting in verse 37, is that right?
37-40.
Okay. And let's see. And when he was come nigh, even now at the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise Elohim with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, Blessed be the King that cometh in the name of Yahweh. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And some of the Pharisees from among the multitude said unto him, Master, rebuke thy disciples. And he answered and said unto them, I tell you, if these should hold their peace, the stones would immediately cry out. And when he was come near, he beheld the city and wept over it, saying, If thou hadst known, even thou, at least in this thy day, the things which belong unto thy peace. But now are they hid from your eyes. For the day shall come upon thee, that thine enemies shall cast a trench upon thee, and compass thee round, and keep thee in on every side, and shall lay thee even with the ground, and thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation. And he went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold therein and them that bought, saying unto them, It is written, My house is the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves. And he taught daily in the temple. But the chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him and could not find what they might do, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. Okay. Baruch HaMelech Haba B'Shem Yahweh. Blessed be the King that cometh in the name of Yahweh.
So why were the Pharisees demanding that he rebuke his students?
Why were the Pharisees demanding that he rebuke his students? Because they were saying, Baruch Haba B'Shem Yahweh. They were saying, they're proclaiming you as Messiah. Okay? Rebuke them. If we look this verse up, let's see. I'll be right back. I'm going to look this one up. It's Psalm 118 and 26. They're quoting Psalm 118 and 26. Psalm 118 in its entirety is a messianic psalm and has always been recognized as that by the Pharisees or by the rabbis. Same thing. But it says, "Blessed is he that cometh in the name of Yahweh, and we have blessed you out of the house of Yahweh." Where was he headed for? He was headed for the temple at that particular time. So, they were declaring him to be Messiah. They weren't saying it in those words any more than he said the exact words, I am the Messiah. Although he did, when the woman in Samaria said, well, we heard the Messiah is coming, and he said, woman, I am he. Declared clearly that he was Messiah. And when John's disciples came and said, are you the one we're looking for? Are you the Messiah we're looking for? Or do we look for another? And he said, look at what I'm doing. You go tell John that the blind see, the lame walk, the deaf hear, the poor have the gospel of peace preached to them. Okay? Go tell John that. And then you tell him that people who believe will have... I mean, he gave kind of a rebuke to John the Baptist. Okay? He told him, by telling him the things that he was doing, that he was Messiah. And that's... The Pharisees were really ticked at him about this.
But I don't think they knew what they were necessarily saying.
Yes, they knew exactly what they were saying. They really thought that he was Messiah. They really knew it. I don't believe that the people turned on him. I don't believe the people turned on him. I believe that the Pharisees and the people that they controlled turned on him. Right. I don't believe that the people as a whole turned on him. Not at all. I believe there are a whole lot of believers that came through that. Other questions or comments?
Definitely an end time thing we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it is definitely end time. 42. If thou hadst known, even thou, at least in this thy day, the things which belong unto thy peace, but now they are hid from thine eyes. See, he was offering them peace with Yahweh. That's what the gospel is all. He preached the gospel of peace. Okay? That's what he was preaching. Peace. You can have peace with Yahweh. Now let me tell you how. And once you are a child of the King, then you are to follow Torah. But you're not following Torah is not going to do you any good if you're not already a child of Yahweh. Let's see. You could have. What he's telling them is you could have been kings and a nation of priests at peace with Yahweh, but you refused. Now an evil will be placed between your eyes and the truth. A veil, rather, will be placed between your eyes and the truth. Do you suppose the strong delusion is adherence to the oral law? I think it's a possibility.
I have a question.
Okay, hold on a minute. Here's a question.
Okay. Supposing this is an end time prophecy, if you notice it says that they will embank around you, surround you, enclose you on every side, and level you and your children within you.
Mm-hmm.
So even at that point, the children within the people, there's still an importance to them.
Mm-hmm. I think that this is talking not just to the people, but to the actual city itself. I mean, he's going to lay the city to the ground. Not a stone left on top of another. That speaks, at least in the Peshat, that speaks to the physical temple being torn down. The children of the temple, are they children of Yahweh or are they children of the temple? Okay? The children of the temple are going to be crushed under those stones. The children of Yahweh, they're going to be delivered. My own personal thoughts on that. Other questions or comments here? No more? I got one more. Let me see if I can read it. Okay, he taught daily in the temple. This day that he came up here was the 10th of the first month, the 10th day of the first month. Okay? It was the day that the high priest had gone out to get the lamb and bring it into the city so that they could watch it for 4 days before the Passover. Okay? And they watched that thing to make sure that it was not just the most beautiful lamb that they had, but also the meekest, the quietest, the nicest lamb they could get their hands on. Okay? And they would, in those 4 days, that thing would become like a pet to them because they had to bring it into their house. Okay? So the priest had this thing in the house of Yahweh and they were taking care of it like it was their own kid. And after 4 days, they had to sacrifice it. Okay? So, that's the idea. They had to get what that Yahweh was doing with Messiah. Okay, so for 4 days, he's on the Temple Mount. He walks in on the 10th, right? He clears the place out of the money changers, and then he leaves. He comes back the next morning, and he's on that Temple Mount all day, answering questions, and there are four different groups of people that ask him questions. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians, and there was somebody else, I can't remember. Oh, it might have been the Romans, actually. Anyway, there are four different people none of them could find any fault in him. He was actually being the Passover lamb, just like the one that they'd been watching for 1,500 years, bringing that lamb in. And for 4 days, they're watching it to see if there's any blemish, and no one can find any blemish in him. And the only one that would actually say there's no blemish in him was Pilate. Okay? I find no fault in this man. 4 times he said it. He said it once for each of the groups of people that were watching him. And so anyway,
say once for each
I say it's once for each, because none of the others, none of the other groups of people that he was questioned by said anything about his being perfectly righteous. But Pilate said it 4 times. So I say that he said it once for each of those groups of people, and once for each day that he was up on that Temple Mount being interrogated, inquisitors, whatever. Okay. In the 4 days that he spent on the Temple Mount being examined for spot or blemish, in 4 days he spent on the Temple Mount being examined for spot and blemish. That's what brought all that on. There's a little note I have in the thing here. People loved him and attended his every word. Political power grabbers were the ones who were the ones threatened by him. Okay? Political power grabbers were the ones who were being threatened by him down here in verse 48. They couldn't find anything, but they were, I'm sorry, in verse 47. But the chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him. Okay? Those are the people that had political and religious power. And they didn't want to lose it. They knew they were going to if this guy had his way. If the people were able to make him Messiah. Okay, so they had to destroy him. It was all over politics. Politics is one of the worst things this world has ever seen. Anybody have any other questions or comments? Have we got anybody left in Pal Talk, or have I chased them all away? Okay. No questions or comments in Pal Talk today? Anymore? I mean, other than the few that we had a few minutes ago? Well, as far as I'm concerned, our midrash is done unless we've got another question or comment here. Going once? Going twice? Liz gave me some popcorn and I got a hull stuck in my throat. It's all Liz's fault.
I would have had a comment about that.
Sold! We're done. Midrash is hereby concluded. Thank you everyone in Pal Talk for hanging around and listening and being bored to tears by Mark because he did most of the talking. And thanks for everybody that had comments, even the ones in Pal Talk. We had 3 or 4 here today. That was really good. And Bill is not feeling well, or we'd be here for another hour and a half or 2 hours, because that's how he is. He's at home not feeling well. Everybody pray for Bill. He just had a cold or something. It wasn't anything serious, but it was enough that he didn't want to pass it on to everyone else. Anyway, peace to you all. Shalom in Messiah Yeshua and Shavua Tov. We'll see you next week.